Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. My guest today is Reverend Mark Lawson Jones, a former rector of Kincoyd Ministry Area for the Church of Wales in Great Britain. Reverend Lawson Jones currently serves with the Mission to Seafarers organization as a chaplain for the Port of South Wales. That organization helps shipworkers cope with piracy, shipwreck, abandonment, and separation from loved ones around the world. Mark is also the author of two books. First, The Little Book of Wales, which is described as an intriguing, fast-paced, fact-packed compendium of places, people, and history in Wales. And the second book, and more importantly for our discussion today, Why Was the Partridge in the Pear Tree? The History of Christmas Carols. We will link to both of those books on our website, as well as some more interesting tidbits about carols. There's a neat little story as to how I happened to come across Mark's book. My wife this year decided to have a little fun with Christmas gifts and give me 12 gifts for the 12 days of Christmas. And on the first day of Christmas, my true love gave to me Why Was the Partridge in the Pear Tree by Reverend Lawson Jones. Now, before we go any further and head off any comments at the pass, I do understand that the 12 days of Christmas start on Christmas Day and extend into the New Year's. I got that. But us Yankees over here, we're an impatient bunch, and we do it leading up to Christmas, at least in the Gill household. In any event, this book came at a very fortuitous time because I was searching around for a Christmas episode, and when I started to peruse this book, I thought it'd make for a great conversation as it is both fun and informative, my favorite kind of books. My only concern was that whether the author was, one, still alive, as my first impression of the history books about carols were generally written in the first half of the 20th century, and two, whether the author was easily accessible in the United States. Well, it turns out that this book was published in 2011. The author is indeed still alive, and I think younger than I am, as it turns out. But alas, I quickly found out that Reverend Lawson Jones was on the other side of the Atlantic pond, which makes interviews a bit more challenging, but thankfully, through the magic of cell phone technology, we're able to have him dial into our studio. Mark, welcome to Research on Religion.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me. It's good to be here.
You are the first guest we've ever had from Wales, so this is very exciting, and I've never been to Wales. But you've written a short book about this nation, and I want to start off by giving you the opportunity to sell me on it. Why should I visit Wales in the near future?
Oh, Wales is an absolutely fantastic place. Even though it's a small nation of only 8,000 square miles, there are 3 million people that live here. We've got more castles per square mile than any other place in Europe, and the reach of Welsh people throughout the world has been really extraordinary. A Welshman, you might not know, invented the equals two and the plus sign for mathematical notation. We invented tennis, and we've also got what's said to be one of the largest Elvis impersonator festivals in the world, with 100 acts over a weekend. It's a strange place, but a very, very good place.
An Elvis impersonation festival. Well, I thought that would be a Tom Jones impersonation festival, but Elvis, I guess, lots of cultural...
I was going to tell you that Tom Jones was our president, but I thought you'd know he wasn't.
So. Oh, very good. Well, we could talk about Wales all day, but we're here actually to celebrate Christmas with singing and merriment. Well, maybe not singing exactly, but at least a discussion of singing. Although if you want to sing, you're perfectly acceptable to do that. So now, as we noted in our introduction, you've written a short book on the history of Christmas carols that covers some interesting stories regarding this tradition writ large, but also some really neat facts about particular carols. Let me start off by asking you, whatever motivated you to write such a book?
Well, it was a strange story, really, because I've always loved Christmas, and it's easily my favorite time of the year. I believe that at Christmas, anything can happen if we can engage with the themes of peace and goodwill, for all humanity, and I was ordained in the year 2000, And I seem to officiate at probably 30 or 40 carol services each year, from residential homes to schools to churches. And I started to wonder about why I was singing what I was singing. When you've sung Hark the Herald Angels Sing that many times, you really do wonder about it. And at one carol service, I decided to shake things up a bit by singing The 12 Days of Christmas, The Partridge in the Pear Tree. And we made lots of mistakes. It went on much longer than it should have. But one of the congregation asked if I'd write a book about carols. It turned out she was a commissioning editor for a publishing company. And it was really, really exciting to write. It gave me the real story behind the people who wrote the carols. It's good.
It must have been really fun to write. Did you have to do a lot of research leading up to this, or did you happen to know all this stuff from your own background, personal history, growing up with carols?
I grew up with Christmas carols, but like many people, I never questioned the origins or the words that are sung, that some of which seem quite strange. And I've never been much of a historian, really. It was through my interest through my 30s that I needed to discover why I did what I did. It was a sort of wider question for myself. I read quite widely for the book about carols. I spoke to the elders in the parishes. I read over-large books like the Oxford Book of Christmas Carols. And I decided that I needed to condense it, really, into a book that other people could read, get lots of knowledge from a few pages, but also start to love carols as much as me. So, never a great historian or a great theologian, I have to say, but it was one of those things I knew I really needed to do.
And I'm glad that you did it, too, because, as I mentioned, I love fun and informative books, and this is a really great read. I received it in the morning about a week ago from my wife, and I just sat down and just tore through it. It's just really fun to read, and it's a quick read, so I recommend everybody get your hands on this. I have to ask, you already mentioned that you did a number of carol services, do about 30 to 40 a year. We're going to talk a little bit about where people carol in other places as well. So to give a little hint for where this is coming from, sometimes these are done in public houses or pubs or taverns, as we call them. Do you do a lot of caroling outside of, you know, the typical church? Do you go to pubs? Do you go door to door and carol, or what there?
Yes, one of my previous parishes was a semi-rural parish with 10 medieval churches, and there were almost different traditions across the Grand Levels, the area where in the most southerly part of Wales, near the English border, the parish was. And two or three of the villages do door-to-door carols, which is always quite challenging to sing in such cold weather, and then maintain your voice for the rest of the Christmas period. But also, in other parts of the parish, they sang in pubs. I really do enjoy singing carols in church, but there's nothing quite like drinking and singing in a pub. At the moment, I'm singing as I walk up and down the quayside to the docks to visit the ships. I'm also trying to encourage some of the seafarers to sing as well, but that's not gone down fantastically well.
Yeah, I know. Ship guys, seafarers, not the most vocal of folks when it comes to caroling, I guess, but it just sounds so fun.
A jolly cleric turning up to encourage them to sing at Christmas, it doesn't always go down the best, but you know, they call Wales the land of song, even though I'm always out of tune. And I'm going to sing carols in the pub this week, and I'll be joining carolers going door to door as well, and also in church. They all seem to fit together really well, and if I don't do one of those three, it doesn't quite seem right.
Yeah, no, fantastic. You mentioned that it gets cold there in Wales, and I haven't been there, but do you get snow at Christmas time? Is there snow there, or are you kind of like out here in Seattle, it's just kind of you know, misty and not quite freezing yet?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been cold, and we have had snow in Wales. In the south, we haven't had much, but because of the Gulf Stream, we don't share the same climate as places like Norway, where snow has been down for weeks and months. It's fairly miserable. It's wet, foggy, and windy, and it does snow sometimes, but I don't think we'll get any this Christmas. It's a real shame.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Same thing we have here out here in Seattle. But caroling always cheers up those moods on those bitterly cold nights and things. So let's dig into the history of caroling. When did carols begin? And when did carols, as we might vaguely recognize them today, come into being?
Well, the carols that we really recognize today came into being in the early 19th century, maybe even the late 18th century. Singing in church before that wasn't really done. The 15th, 16th century, it was chants, and there would have been no real choral singing, as we'd say.
Even though the current carols, and a number of we'll discuss later, don't come into being until the early 19th century, you do trace this back, the idea of caroling, to the middle part of the medieval period, into the 13th century and stuff. Tell us a little bit about what was going on then. How does this process of caroling evolve?
Well, yes, this is a great mystery, really, of Adeste Fideles, O Come All Ye Faithful. No one's really sure, but many theologians and people who study music think it may well be the oldest. It's certainly shrouded in mystery. Saint Bonaventure, a 13th century scholar, is accredited with this carol, and it could have been in Portuguese, German, or Spanish originally, translated by Cistercian monks. But it was the work in the last century of a monk, Don Stefan, of the Order of St. Benedict, who dug out old, old manuscripts going back to the early 18th century. It's a very, very interesting carol because John Francis Wade, who was born in 1711, fled to France in the Jacobite Rebellion. And they suggest that it was written as a sort of political call to arms, for France to invade England and restore the Catholic throne and end the persecutions. So O Come All Ye Faithful, or the faithful, were considered to be the Jacobites, and of course the Holy Land, Bethlehem, was considered to be England. So with all this sort of noise over the top of where the carol actually came from, it's difficult to tell. Wade certainly had many different versions of the carol, and Dom Stefan, who started to do a huge, almost life work of finding out about this carol, is convinced that's what it was about.
Wow, that is fascinating to think about. A carol that I love to sing, and I love that carol specifically, is a warning about an invasion to Britain. Wow, who knew?
Yes, absolutely.
How about the association with greenery? You talk about this early as well, that the theme of holly and ivy comes up quite a bit in these very early 14th, 15th, 16th century carols. What is that all about?
The holly, the holly and the ivy is a very ancient carol also. But for Christians, the holly symbolizes Jesus. And the white blossom, the purity of Jesus Christ, and the scarlet berries, his blood, and the prickle being a premonition of the crown of thorns at his crucifixion. And the question that was always asked, really, is why holly? Well, the Christian faith dates back to Wales and Britain to the 5th century when the Romans left. And the holly and ivy would have been used by them for the midwinter feast of Saturnalia. Of course, they're green throughout the year, and it was seen as something that would, if you celebrated with holly and ivy, you would guarantee good fortune in agriculture for the year. And of course, Saturnalia around Christmas would have been the coldest part of the year, so the people would have needed something to celebrate. And just like many of the old traditions or the old religions and the pagan festivals, Christianity has been sort of superimposed upon it. And it started in the 6th century when St. Austin baptized 10,000 Anglo-Saxons. And we're told in old history that the churches and houses were bedecked with holly and ivy. And really then, I suppose the rest is history. It's been a symbol of Christmas and decorating ready for the celebrations. Incidentally, for Saturnalia, the Roman festival, the holly was masculine and the ivy was feminine, so it also represented the battle of the sexes, really. And there was a dance for men and women. This is a great thing of history and traditions being old and new at the same time and being overlaid on each other almost. It's really, really good.
Now, one of the traditions that you talk about is something known as wassailing. And this is one of the funnest chapters of the book. I love wassail, which is a drink, but also wassailing is a verb, something that you do. Many of us probably recognize the carol, "Here We Come, a Wassailing," but I bet most of us don't even know what that is. So please tell us about the interesting characteristics about a wassailing and how it developed over time.
Well, yeah, wassailing is so famous, it's got its own song, I suppose. The historian Geoffrey of Monmouth, in the very early 12th century, he mentions it. And there's a story to go with it. King Vortigern was king of the Britons, and he meets Rowena, the daughter of Hengist, who's a mercenary who served him. Now, Rowena was a really, really beautiful woman. And she gave him a goblet full of wine and said, "Wife, hail, good health," in the old language. And the king's interpreter said he should respond with, "Drink, hail." And he took a drink and gave the goblet back. Then the tradition then followed. Who drinks first says, "Wife, hail," and the partner responds, "Drink, hail." But the story didn't end greatly. Unfortunately, Rowena seduces Vortigern and Hengist massacres the Britons at a peace conference. And at this stage, it was a declaration or a greeting, but eventually it became an activity for communities to start celebrating the importance of togetherness and all they shared and a dependence, really, on one another in the cold winter for survival. The wassail bowl developed over the centuries, was made from wood, and the drink travelled around the villages. It was filled with alcohol, especially in the south of England, Devon, Somerset, Hereford, Gloucester and Essex. And people drank from the bowl to share that sort of sense of togetherness. It's a really important symbol.
One of the other things that you talk about in here too is not only the bowl. The bowl discussion is fascinating because there are these wooden bowls carved out. They're carrying these things around, but it also is a festival that doesn't go on in churches. It goes out in orchards, and there's this tradition of dipping bread into the wassail and hanging bread from trees. What is that all about?
It's another one of these wonderful traditions where in the orchards, villagers would gather on Twelfth Night at the end of the Christmas celebrations before Epiphany in the Western Christian calendar, and they'd select the king and the queen in really elaborate ceremonies. And then they'd be led to the trees where the bread was soaked in cider, usually from the bowl, and it would be placed by the new royalty on the branches. And whilst it's being done, the villagers would bang pots and pans and sing and beat the tree with sticks to wake it up, to wake up the tree from its winter sleep. Of course, this is to ensure a really good harvest, and that the tree will sort of survive through the worst parts of winter. It still takes place in many places in the UK that produce cider.
I just would be so enchanted to see one of these celebrations back a few hundred years ago with people banging on pots and pans and beating trees with sticks while drinking alcohol. I just, this a fascinating, fun thing to do, right? This is just a really, dark time of the year where the sun sets, it's miserable weather, but people are still out there having fun. And you mentioned that it's still practiced today. And one of the sections you have in that chapter is a Welsh practice of something called Mari Lind. You going to have to pronounce that for me. I can't pronounce the Welsh very well, but what is this ceremony?
It's one of my favorites, being Welsh and from Wales myself. It's called colloquially Mari Lloyd, but in the Welsh language it would be Fari Lloyd. The M for Mari would mutate to a V sound with the letter F, and it's it's a tradition that's always sat really comfortably with all the other traditions of Wassail. It's a popular tradition, and the name, it means Grey Mare in Welsh. And what happens is the community will produce a horse's skull with a sprung lower jaw, and they'll mount it on a pole, and it'll be covered in a white sheet, leather reins with bells held by the leader. So it's a sort of animatronic horse that will go around the villages. And it's really a singing contest. The revelers will challenge householders, and they'll knock their door. And in Wales, we're really, really proud of our singing raw Welsh talent. And it still continues to this day throughout Wales as a nation. And householders knew that the Mary Lloyd were sailors would be calling, and they'd plan their defence in advance. They'd either plan to visit this with alcohol or food, or they'd challenge them to a sort of choral contest. And if they lost, a joker would play pranks, a bit like Halloween, I suppose. And that joker would accompany the Mary Lloyd party. It's been reintroduced in many rural parts of Wales. I've no idea why it disappeared. It could have been in the last century between the wars because of austerity. The idea of going out and sharing lots of alcohol with people might have been something that was too costly for many to do. But it's lovely to see in Wales that this great tradition starts again.
Yeah, you mentioned that some people are still starting to do it now, and it just sounds absolutely delightful.
Yeah. It's really good. One of the funny things is that when the Mary Lloyd party sing, they'll sing something like, "Open your doors, let us come and play. It's as cold as snow at Christmastide." And the housekeepers can either repel them or invite them in merely by the strength and quality of their choral singing. If all battles could be resolved like that, I think the world would be a much better place.
Oh, most definitely. It'd just be a fun place. The battles would be fun because singing contests are very fun. And you have a number of pictures here in the book as well, not only the history, but some contemporary pictures of people dressed up in funny hats. And you have the mayor's skull and all that. And then you also have one of a butler coming out, I guess, repelling or inviting people in. And it's such an interesting picture because even though it's in black and white, you can see the cheeks of the butler blushing as he's singing uproariously. And it's very cool. Like I love this book. It's really neat. Are there any specific songs associated with Mary Lloyd?
Yes, one of my favorite is Oes Gavaretto, and it's in Welsh, it means, "Are there any goats?" When the Mary Lloyd party arrive at a house, they'd say, "Oes bywyd yma," "Is there any food here?" And if the answer came oes, or the negative is nac oes in the Welsh language, there'd be one more question, "Oes Gavaretto," "Are there any goats?" And then this song would take place in the beautiful, poetic Welsh language, and the Mary would run wildly around, snapping at the people present. And the song is really, the question is, "Are there any goats?" In translation, it's, "Is there another goat that's not been milked on the craggy rocks? The old goat is wandering, a white, white, white goat. Yes, a white lip, white lip, white lip. A white tail, white tail. A white flank and tail, white, white, white." And they go through colors of goats. There's a white goat, a black goat, a red goat, a blue goat. And even though there are significant regional variations in Wales, they always end up with a pink goat right at the end. And wherever you are in Wales, when Oes Gavaretto is sung, the very last verse is asking about the pink goats. So it's I've no idea about the history in the sense of where it came from, but it's a party song for people who are, you know, surviving the cold winter, but also having a lot of fun in what can be very rural and distant communities in Wales.
Yeah, you mentioned just the fun of doing this, and it's in this chapter as well that you mentioned people today still go around to public houses, to pubs, to taverns, and they sing. Do you have any particular favorite stories from going around to these pubs and singing carols? Do people readily jump in, or do you really have to prod people to start singing some of these carols?
The Welsh people need no excuse to sing. If someone starts singing in a pub or a tavern, most people will join in. It's just what we do, really. One of the traditions I found from another part of Britain is I lived in Derbyshire for a time, and whereas they don't have the Mary Lloyd, they have pub singing, and this has been kept going for hundreds and hundreds of years, whether or not the churches were singing. All the most important carols in places like Derbyshire are sung in the pub. And one of the great things is they have different versions, and different teams will turn up to pubs. And I went to a pub in Derbyshire maybe a decade ago, and they sang 28 versions of While Shepherds Watched. I lost count after about 15, and on the way out I asked how many versions were actually sung. But almost with each few versions you drink another pint of beer. Which is a tradition, so that's probably why I forgot. But it's absolutely fantastic. All these traditions are wonderful for social cohesion and celebrating, you know, the best of what it is to live in community. They're so important. And Christmas is that time to do it.
I wholeheartedly agree with that, and I just find it wonderful to see these traditions being carried out in taverns, even when they're not singing in churches, because I've argued many times that taverns are great places for people to get together and lay their differences aside and just to celebrate life as it is. One of the other chapters in your book, though, tells us about a time when Christmas was almost eliminated by some folks called the Puritans. So what happened with these festive traditions and wassailing and all that stuff when the Puritans started to gain some influence in the 17th and early 18th centuries?
This is probably one of the most sad chapters for me in sort of history of Britain, I suppose. You know, they killed off Christmas. It was extremely popular for many of the communities, this sense of togetherness. And there were minstrels, travelling players, decorations, the holly, ivy and rosemary, and communities did celebrate the best of what it was to be together. There were struggles because of harsh winters, and their interdependence was rediscovered. But because of the stories of drunkenness and debauchery, the Puritans got very upset. And in 1642, they outlawed plays and pageants and all the other great things about Christmas at the time. And eventually, they declared celebrating Christmas as anti-Christian. And they were told to do nothing special at Christmas. There are reports of riots in London because London shopkeepers were told that they must remain open, and they closed their shops and took to the streets and said, "Our shops are closed because it's Christmas, and we're off to celebrate." So the people spoke, really. And that lasted for quite a long time, almost 50 years. And then some rights were restored, but not many. And then books with carols started reappearing in around 1707, 1710. So I suppose the enforced austerity and the you know, the denial of the celebration of Christmas meant that when it came back and some rights were restored, people felt the need to make Christmas a very special time.
And I'm glad that they did, because I don't think I could have lasted those 50 or 60 years in the puritanical no Christmas period. This is one of my favorite times of the year. And as you mentioned,
it does. It must have been absolutely awful.
I know. But fortunately, it does not last that long. We're in a time where caroling is still very important to us. And you talk about a period of time in the 19th century, and you hinted about this a little bit earlier, what is called as the Golden Age of Carols. And this is where we develop a lot of the carols that we sing today, a lot of ones that people would recognize. What was magical about the 1800s that brought all these carols and people wanting to carol more to the front?
Well, people had been singing more. There had been carols slowly making a reappearance. But what really happened, there was the rediscovery of the first Noel, the carol we enjoy and still sing to this day. And in 1823, two people, Sandys and Gilbert, wrote a book, Carols Ancient and Modern. They thought that they were writing a history of carols, but they were actually laying the foundations for Christmas, that we really celebrate today. There was God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen, I Saw Three Ships, and these were absolutely wonderful books. And when you look at the text, they would have had a sort of an inquiry. A letter would be sent saying, Mrs. Smith from Coventry remembers her father singing a song about shepherds to the tune of, and they'd go off to investigate. It was sort of detective work, which they thought was historical, but it was actually the foundations for Christmas for today. And without them, I think we probably would have been stuck. We would have had less carols, and the celebration wouldn't have been half as good. And then the ascension to the throne of Queen Victoria in 1837 was a huge boost to those who wished to celebrate Christmas, bringing with it sort of Victorian family values. Family and togetherness became really important. Presents were given and received for the first time, and clergy were actually allowed to teach parishioners Christmas songs and carols. And then, of course, Prince Albert introduced the Christmas tree, and it's sort of all coming together, really, for Christmas, you know, at this time. And 150, 160, 170 years later, I suppose we could say very little's changed. But the Christmas we enjoy today is largely Victorian.
Well, let's go ahead and review and talk about some of the carols that we do enjoy today and the significance of some of these. You have about a dozen or so in the book, starting with one that is actually a pretty sad song, and I hadn't really realized that. Most of the carols that I listen to, especially at this time, I have it in the background while I'm working. They're usually acoustic or instrumental versions of these different carols, and one of my favorite ones is known as the Coventry Carol, but that has a really interesting meaning to it. Tell us about the Coventry Carol.
I think the music to the Coventry Carol is just full of Christmas, isn't it? It really is. It's something that when we hear it on the radio or hear it played in our towns and cities, it just evokes so much in us. But it's not as familiar to those who enjoy singing upbeat and lively carols, but it's the lament of a mother, really, for her son. It's one of the oldest in existence, and it's named after the city Coventry, where it was part of a 16th century pageant. I think it was called Pageant of the Shearmen and Tailors. And it depicts Herod's slaughter of the innocents, the story from the Bible. It's about the infanticide of the king of Judea, Herod, when he heard the reports from the wise men that the Christ child was to be born in Bethlehem. So he sends soldiers to kill all the firstborn in order to avoid losing his throne to the Christ child, who the Magi, the king, said would be king. And the incident is described as fulfilling the prophecy made hundreds of years earlier by the prophet Jeremiah in the Old Testament. The music is as evocative as the story is sad. And for me, even when I hear the music, I think of all the genocides that take place to this day and all those women that mourn their children that have been kept down in war and violence throughout the world. So it's one of those carols, whether I sing it or hear the music, that really plants my feet back in the 21st century, remembering that if we're ever going to really understand the meaning of Christmas, we need to make Christmas last every day and not just one day each year.
That's a very good lesson to be pulling from that. As I mentioned, it's one of the carols that when I play them, especially the instrumental version, it gives me a sense of peace. And now that I really kind of recognize that background, it's kind of a sullen peace, I guess, the one that needs to take the lessons from this much more seriously. But there are a number of songs that are actually quite upbeat, and that's the one part of these carols that I love. It's just fun going out to pubs and singing these songs. Everybody knows them and that. A couple of ones that you talk about, let's talk about The Holly and the Ivy. That's another one of my favorites. What is going on with that carol?
Well, I suppose, as I mentioned earlier, it's the overlay, really, between the pagan and the Christian. It's the sense that the holly and the ivy from the old Saturnalia festival of the Romans has been nuanced, shall we say, or you know, shared with the earliest Christians in Britain, especially. And there was a real importance of holly and ivy being something, being green through the winter showed sort of fertility. And also there's the Battle of the Sexes, the male holly and the female ivy. And there are even dances to it in older days.
The next one you cover, too, is another upbeat one, Hark the Herald Angels Sing. This is a very optimistic song about the glory to the newborn king who's coming. Tell us about a little bit about the history of Hark the Herald Angels Sing.
Well, Hark the Herald Angels Sing was from one of the most prolific hymn writers ever, possibly. Certainly that Britain ever produced, Charles Wesley. At the time, he was struggling with ill health, and he was really re-evaluating his ministry and what he wanted to do. He was educated at Westminster College, leaving with a scholarship to study in Christ College, Oxford. This is where his brother John Wesley formed the Oxford Holy Club for the purposes of Christian worship, and they, of course, became the Methodists. But Wesley eventually became a college tutor, and he left to be ordained as a deacon, but made the disastrous move of moving to Georgia in the new colonies, where he intended to work as a missionary. But he became a secretary to the governor and returned really emotionally drained. The people that got him back on the right track were the Moravians, the Moravian church that was present in London at the time. And later that year, when he was really questioning what his purpose was in life, he preached at St. Mary's Church in Islington, that you can still visit today, and he administered the chalice at Holy Communion. And stories tend to suggest that Wesley heard the sound of the bells ringing on his way to church on Christmas Day, and they filled him with a deep happiness to pen Hark, the Herald Angels Sing. Now, there's no evidence that this is the case at all, and through my research, I actually found out that the original words written by Wesley were not Hark the Herald Angels Sing, but Hark all Welkin Rings. Now, Welkin is an old English word for heaven. So Hark all Heaven Rings. And I think he'd be spinning in his grave to know that later on George Whitfield repenned some of the lyrics to say Hark the Herald Angels Sing, because as a good biblical scholar, Wesley would have known in the Gospel of Luke, it says that the angels don't sing. It says that they announce. Our picture of singing angels would have upset Wesley. But nevertheless, this is the carol that I can honestly say, as a practicing cleric, is sung in 95% of carol services at the end. And, really, it's classic, isn't it? It's the one that really winds us up and fills us with joy and happiness before we go back out into the cold. It's great.
Yeah, exactly. Same feeling I have as you hark the herald angels sing, and then I want to go out and herald the good news that is coming to the world. Another one that calls people out is O Come All Ye Faithful. Tell us a little bit about that one.
O Come All Ye Faithful, Adeste Fidelis, has got really quite a history. There's the history of its origins that run down many centuries. But one of the really important things, especially at a time this year, really, is to remember, is that this was one of the hymns that was recorded as being sung in the ceasefire in the trenches on the first Christmas of World War I. It's reported that on the 17th of December, 1914, Pope Benedict the 15th called for a temporary truce and ceasefire on the battlefield. Germany agreed, but the other powers refused, and the war had been raging for barely 5 months. Families sent packages of cigarettes, warm clothing, gifts, and medicines to the soldiers, and some of the German soldiers had also received decorations from loved ones because it was their practice to decorate trees. And in the cold mud of that awful battlefield, Christmas trees started to appear, lit by candles. And eventually, troops came from both sides to the line, and they started to sing carols to each other. And it was a British soldier, Private Oswald Tilley, who commented in a letter that "O Come All Ye Faithful" was sung. The first one sung was the first Noel, and they finished and clapped. They struck up other favourites like the German "O Tannenbaum," and it went on, and they sang "O Come All Ye Faithful," and they joined in with the words, the Latin words, "Adeste Fidelis." And, you know, I can't help thinking that if this ceasefire had been agreed, there was countless millions of people wouldn't have died in the noise and chaos of war, and the world would be a really different place, especially for Britain. Whole generations were lost. One of the things that I find quite sad as well is that we all know the story about the war stopping just for Christmas Day, and that's in our folk memory, I suppose. But the truth is that two-thirds of the Western Front of the war stopped fighting. Now, the Western Front was 450 miles long, so we're not just talking about one group of soldiers. And in many places, the ceasefire, the unofficial ceasefire, the truce, the peace, went on until March, and they only resumed fighting in some places where they were threatened with court-martial and summary execution. So some of the things we look on over Christmas to be good and fill us full of spirit of Christmas, the stories behind them are really quite sad, really quite sad.
They're quite sad, but also reassuring of human nature, is that you hear the song, "O Come All Ye Faithful," and you realize that we are all the faithful. It doesn't matter where politicians draw border lines and nations or anything. It's that you can come together, and that somebody from the German side and somebody from the Allied side can be singing these songs. They have it in common, and we realize our common humanity here. So even though it's sad, there, I think there's a glimmer of hope in all this stuff as well. Let me ask you about two other ones that you have. You have, as I mentioned, about a dozen or so specific ones in here, but to move things along here in terms of time, Silent Night, Holy Night, and Good King Wenceslas. Give us some idea of those. Let's start with Silent Night, Holy Night. That's probably one of the most widely recognized carols of all time.
It is. It's another beautiful carol, and even as we say the words, we can almost hear the tune in our minds. It's great. It was written by Joseph Moore with a melody from Franz Xaver, David Gruber, Silent Night, Holy Night. And it was first performed at Midnight Mass on Christmas Eve in St. Nicholas Church in Oberndorf in Austria. And since then, I think it's just grown in popularity. If you search the internet, as I did, you'll find there are 200 versions in at least 150 different languages. It was meant to be accompanied on the guitar, which makes it fairly unique as well. And at the end of the six verses, the choir would repeat the last two lines in the four-part harmony, "Sleep in heavenly peace." And but the simplicity of the tune was great for such simple and basic accompaniment. Yeah, I do like it. It's really good. They always seem to sing it at schools when I visit for the nativity plays, right in the middle, and that's the point where you can see the parents in the congregation sort of throw with a tear in their eye as the children sing Silent Night, Holy Night. It's a wonderful thing.
And that it is written for guitar is if you ever get a chance to listen to it just with one acoustic guitar, it's just such a beautiful piece of music. How about Good King Wenceslas? I mean, that's a fun one, and I have to admit, this is probably one of my top two favorite carols because it just gets me in a festive spirit. Tell us about Good King Wenceslas.
It's a really jolly one, isn't it? It's fantastically upbeat. It's Good King Wenceslas. It was written by John Mason Neal, and this tells a story as well about the man that wrote this favorite carol of many people. And this sort of gives a good example of why I wrote the book. Now, John Mason Neal was very traditional. He was a traditionalist in the church. He bordered in the Anglican church, but on the Roman Catholic end. He liked his rituals. and incense and candles and bells. And he was being persecuted, if you like, by his bishop, who didn't like him being so high church. And he looked back to his heroes, heroes of the faith. And through history, he researched good King Wenceslas, and he sees the good king was protected by his grandmother, who was a faithful Christian. And the faith was threatened at the time because his father had been killed in battle. And Wenceslas became a king at 18, and there were stories of absolutely great generosity. He gives gifts to the poor, and he's followed by a servant, and Wenceslas's feet melt the snow as they go to visit people to give out gifts. It really embodies and embodied for Neil the importance of sticking to the faith, sticking to his traditions, and the great traditions of social justice that brought with it. Each carol means something different to each of us, but for Neil, it was something that talked about his deep affinity, really, for those who really had to struggle to keep their tradition, to keep their faith, even though they were good people, socially just and upstanding and charitable within their communities.
Okay, now we have to come to the question that is center to your book. Why was the partridge in the pear tree? It comes from the carol, The 12 Days of Christmas. Tell us a little bit about the background of that song, as well as answering the eternal question, what was that bird doing there?
Well, I suppose the answer to your question of why was the partridge in the pear tree is because he was French. But I'll come back to that in a few moments. The origins of the song are unknown. It's hugely probable that it was one of these memory games. I play a game with my kids about making a pizza. I'll say, I made a pizza, I put cheese and tomato, and then I put chicken. So they'll say cheese, tomato, and chicken. And then I'll say banana or something really strange. And we try and remember. There are many parlor games like this. And the whole idea of the partridge in the pear tree was almost certainly that it was a parlor game. You needed to remember all the things in the list. And it would have been used for the 12th night celebrations at the end of Christmas as Epiphany started. It was found in this form in a children's book, Mirth Without Mischief, which was published in the late 18th century. And it contained pastimes for families and communities to play together. Now, if the game were written 200 years before the book were printed, it wouldn't have made a lot of sense to the British people, because in Britain, partridges didn't fly then, and they certainly didn't perch in pear trees. And this is why the partridge was in the tree, because he was French. The red-legged or French partridge perches in trees, where the English one or common grey partridge doesn't. But the French red-legged partridge wasn't introduced until Britain until the 1770s. So my question from my own research is, why were we singing this song? Well, I think it was a French song and game indeed we adopted, because the word perdrix is French for partridge. And also it could have been a partridge une perdrix. In the French, and we imagined it was pear tree when it was just a translation of partridge. But it's got a very strange history, a very strange history.
And it's a history that you can read about in Reverend Mark Lawson's book, Why Was the Partridge in the Pear Tree? The History of Christmas Carols, and has a number of other great stories about other carols that you are probably familiar with as well. We'll link to that book on our website. Let me go ahead and conclude with two questions for you, basically reflections on what you've learned over the course of researching and writing this book. First of all, why are carols so important to the Christmas season, even up to today, and what have you learned in the study of the history of carols that has surprised you?
Well, that's a very good question. I think I've learned that carols are so important because they remind us that in a world of war, intolerance, and uncertainty, we should reach for the higher order things that can create a better future. You know, love, generosity, charity, peace. And we sing about these things at Christmas. And I know that the people that sing these carols deep down do understand that we need a better world. And I really do wish it could be Christmas every day. For many, at Christmas, anything can be possible. Social media and Facebook will be full of individual acts of kindness and charity and generosity. And these are all good things, but I just wish I could see them all more, not just at Christmas, but throughout the world as well. And that's why carols are so important, because they take us back to what we know. And we know that whether we lived 500 years ago in a village or whether we live in a city with 10 million people, we're all dependent on the people around us to live life well and to celebrate what it is to be human. And so my love of Christmas carols and my love of Christmas, I never make any apologies for. And I believe that, you know, through my own faith, this gives us the ability to, you know, really pray and hope for a better future, but not just pray and hope, but work for it as hard as we can as well. You asked me a question then, what I've learned in my study that surprised me. Well, I've learned that carols, especially my favourite carols, have been written by real people with their own history and their own struggles and their own problems. And it's as if down the generations they're encouraging us to listen to the history of their struggles, sing their carols, and make Christmas special too. It's a wonderful thing. And I really do believe that each year, as we as humanity celebrate Christmas, we're adding to this story of Christmas that started all those years ago. And it's a great thing. It really, really is. We do build something. Something is incarnated. The love of Christ in community. But also, hopefully, the world steps forward. I think it's really important.
Amen to that. My guest has been Reverend Mark Lawson-Jones. Mark, thanks for being us. Mark, thanks for being with us on Research on Religion, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.